in the 1930s, they acquired, in terms of the Marxist parties, they acquired two roles. The first role was, as Stalin once said, artists are engineers of the soul. So we are building a new Russia, so artists must help us create this new Russia. And I think Mao also said similar things. You know, we are building a new China. The role of artists is to help us build that new China. So it was quite ambiguous, because it gave intellectuals a role in Russia and China. Intellectuals had, certainly in Russia, had their own conferences, they had their own state organizations, they were given a lot of prestige and power and resources, but they were under the central control of the party. So they were important, but also controlled. So there were many intellectuals in the West were both attracted and repelled by that. And there's, in fact, there's a new book that's just come out about Western intellectuals visiting China. But the story of Western intellectuals visiting Russia is also very long. That they're very attracted to this role, but also they're scared of being taken over by the party. That's an old story, really. And I think the other role of engineer, so we've got one role to be engineer of the soul. The other role is actually to, and especially with international academics, intellectuals, they were expected to show their allegiance to the idea of communism. And in fact, many of the most important intellectuals, such as Picasso, never became Communist Party members, or not so much later. They never became, because actually they were more valuable when they were not party members, because they could show that the bourgeois intellectual, the humanistic intellectual, had chosen communism, and that it shows that it was socialism and communism that had taken the role of enlightenment and modernity from decadent capitalism. So you get this in the 50s and 60s as well, with the big competitions between Russia and America about art, about classical music, about painting, ballet, dance. It's almost like while they were not firing missiles at each other, they were, you know, we've got the greatest ballet dancers, well, we've got the greatest artists, well, we've got the greatest intellectuals. Because that way you could say we, the Soviet system, is the progressive force of humanity. So there was this internal, external role for the artist intellectual in both China, I think, and Russia, certainly. And the problems, criticisms of that, again, are well known. I'm not going to go them into too much. It's the authority of the party, which was strongly asserted as the representative of the people, against freedom of information, freedom of opinion. And yet, some people might say, well, that's just bourgeois freedom. But other people say, no, you need to hear opinion. You need that information, otherwise you're going to make mistakes. And, you know, that China, of course, has got some classic examples of that, as did Russia, etc. The other aspect is that somehow culture has to be autonomous, even maybe in communism, socialism, it has to be autonomous. Why? Why is that? And I think this question that art should be free, art has to be free, raises questions not just about information and opinion, but also of aesthetics. And this question of that role of aesthetics here brings us back to some of the things I was talking about yesterday morning. Because I think we now need to go back to those questions of the artistic critique, the social critique, and see it not just as a question of intellectuals versus the workers, intellectuals, artists versus the party, but actually as maybe something, a deeper question, and something that's really important over the last 30 years. So this second interpretation of this argument is that it's a problem around aesthetics, not a sociological problem, or not just a sociological problem. And what it comes out of is a sense that the artistic critique of capitalism becomes more powerful in the 19th century. Now, yesterday morning, I talked about aesthetics. I talked about Kant and Schiller and those sorts of people. And if you remember, bourgeois aesthetics was very much that in the realm of art was the realm of freedom. That freedom, self-determination, play, life as an end in itself, non-instrumental, this could exist in the realm of art. And whereas the rest of the world was about markets, administration, rationality, etc. And I think by the 1820s and 1830s, they were met with the rise of the working class, with the rise of industrialization, the rise of capitalism, the growth of cities. We saw this morning with Andrew, the rise of modernity. Those traditional bourgeois aesthetics began to break down. And we broke down into two tendencies. The first was what came to be known as art for art's sake. I won't talk about it too much, but it was a big movement of the 30s and 40s that art should have no other service, no other purpose than itself. The only purpose art should set is to be beautiful. Doesn't matter about anything else. And then on the other side was what we might call social realism, that the job of art, the work of art, was to show social suffering, social problems. And these two opposites, if you like, became powerful currents in artistic debates in the 1830s and 1840s. And this one, one of the classic social realists in painting is Gustav Courbet, who was a revolutionary, a romantic, a very big, loud figure. And he does this painting in 1848. Now, 1848 in European history is a very, very important date because it's the year of revolutions. And right across Europe, there are revolutions. And within 2 years, those revolutions were put down. And many Marxist writers, and we'll see that in a minute, see 1848 as the date when the bourgeoisie, before then they were leading modernity, they were the Enlightenment force. After 1848, they're going to go against it. Now, if you remember, maybe you heard about this yesterday afternoon with the lecture on Marx and modernity. But Marx wrote his Communist Manifesto in 1846, I believe, just at this time, and he's saying the bourgeoisie are the revolutionaries. You know, capitalism is destroying the old, destroying tradition, and it will completely take over the world. And when it has done, then the proletariat will take, etc., etc. 1848, many people saw the bourgeoisie, well, we don't want revolution. So they stepped back from being the leaders of modernity. And many artists were sort of caught on this. And this is a picture by Gustav Courbet. I'm aware that Andrew will know more about this painting than I do, but it's about his uncle being buried. And it's based on a very traditional kind of form, which is a history painting. Now, history painting is very much about histories of kings and queens, the elites or gods and goddesses. But now we've got it's a very big canvas, huge canvas, 20 feet, probably about the length of this stage. And yet it's about peasants or normal, average people. There's a priest there and things, but it's actually about people in dirty shoes. And in those days, that was quite revolutionary and quite shocking. But it's also the French people. It's the last real point at which all of the French society come together as the people. And what Courbet is sort of saying, and I base my argument on an English writer, T.J. Clark, what Courbet is saying is almost You are to the bourgeoisie, you are the people. You middle class, you are still the people. You are earth. You are buried in the earth. You are part of the earth. We are all as one. And so it's this moment where the bourgeoisie are still a radical class. And so we've got this socialist, social realism, but also this call for the middle class to acknowledge that they're part of the people. They're part of France. And so we get this idea of realism, which becomes a major, probably the major aesthetic theory for mainstream Marxism until the 1960s. There are others, but it's very much about that art should find a social responsibility. Rather like Courbet with his, you know, the people need to become, or the bourgeoisie need to become the people. Well, the artist needs to become the people, needs to speak to the people. And so we get the art and the social question, and many, many pictures showing peasants, workers, people in, you know, poverty, people in distress, and that this would show social conscience. And of course, there's a very famous book by Chernyshevsky, the Russian, and it's a novel. And much later, Lenin wrote his own book, What Is to Be Done, based on that title. And Chernyshevsky in that book says, "What I would rather have a pair, or the peasants would rather have a pair of warm winter boots than the works of Shakespeare." And it's a very strong sense of, unless you've got material comfort, culture is nothing. It's a very radical sort of Russian rejection of culture when there's people still in poverty. So there's a very strong sense of that. And this idea of realism, very strong in, just give you some examples of this. This probably can't see them very well, but this is Repin. Ilya Repin, a socialist realist in Russia, or he was at this time. And here's a classic picture. It's very much like Courbet's Burial, but maybe 40 years on. And here he's showing poverty. I don't know if you can see the cripple and the beggars there. And then there's the church and the rich people. He's attempting to show society as a whole. In this little religious procession in Kursk, he's talking to the Russian people as a whole. He's not just focusing on the rich, he's not just focusing on the spiritual, but he's got these beggars in the dirty street with their dirty shoes on. And it's this idea that realism somehow can address society as a whole and make us see that society as a whole. And I can't use novels, but of course novels also tried to do this, as I'll talk about in a minute. And of course, this is much the very famous Volga Boatman, where he's showing the suffering, labouring serfs of Russia. And it's a very revolutionary painting, you know. And this also is a huge painting, huge thing. You see it in St. Petersburg, and it's like, this is the people, and they're suffering. And so it's a very radical statement. Now, it's this tradition of realism that informs socialist realism, which I'll talk a bit more about later. It goes into the socialist tradition because what it does is claim to show society, and therefore it can claim to show all its problems and its sufferings in this way. But there's another tradition that comes out of 1848, and it's not exactly art for art's sake. And if you ever get time, Pierre Bourdieu wrote a very nice book on Flaubert, or a book with a big section on Flaubert. And Gustave Flaubert wrote two very famous books. He wrote others, but these are the most famous one. Madame Bovary, which maybe you know, it's about a woman, a young woman who's married to a very, 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 very boring man who falls in love with a young, I think he's a student or a young doctor. And has an affair and commits suicide. Yeah, I've spoiled the book for you. But she's a romantic. She reads novels, she reads newspapers. Oh, I want a love affair. Oh, I want to be a tragic heroine. And she gets to be one. but it's set in a boring small town in France. And Flaubert is writing a social realist novel. It's got absolutely clear descriptions of everything. Very famously, it starts off with a description of Charles Bovary's hat. It's got this very fancy hat, and it's the page is this long describing this hat. So it's a very socialist realist, but at the same time, it's not. It's actually something like art for art's sake, because Flaubert spends a day writing one sentence. It's the form of the novel becomes something as important as what he's showing, and it's a very interesting thing. And it was, because of course when it was published, it was banned. He was Flaubert was taken to court for pornography, basically an offence to morals, because he was seen to be encouraging young women to sleep with men who were, you know, to commit adultery, to go outside their marriage. But of course, it was shocking in other ways, in that it was not a socialist realist novel. It was an art for art's sake novel written in terms of social realism. And Sentimental Education, which was written about 15 years later, really. Again, here we have a classic realist novel. A young man from the provinces, from a country town, comes to Paris, and he is ambitious, and he wants to become a writer. He wants to marry a beautiful woman. He wants to go into the high society. In Balzac, for instance, Balzac was writing in the 1830s and 40s, many stories about the young man comes to the city, makes his fortune. And Balzac, by showing how he goes up and usually then falls down, says how bad society is, or the nature of modern society. But Flaubert says something different. He's actually saying it's almost like history is meaningless. During the 1848 revolution, it's set during 1848 revolution, and in for Victor Hugo, when he writes Les Misérables, it's all about the barricades and shooting, and the hero is in the middle of the barricades, and the hero of Sentimental Education is with his mistress in a carriage. And he's finally got this woman he really likes. He's finally got her into this carriage, and he pulls the blinds down and drives, and just says, "Right, drive me around Paris." And he drives around Paris, and there's this revolution going on. But he's not looking at it. He's just indulging himself with his beautiful lady. And so Flaubert is doing something very, very difficult in that way. And this is why we might say he's the first modernist writer, where he starts to play around with the form itself. Baudelaire, maybe we talked about this morning, Baudelaire again writes The Flowers of Evil, Les Fleurs du Mal. Same time as Flaubert, also gets into trouble for pornography, because he writes about prostitutes and things like that. What does Baudelaire do? It's lyric poetry, and lyric poetry means it's all about himself, which is fine. It's not epic, it's not about history and things. But the self is in the city, and the self is very fragmented, strange, new kinds of desires, melancholy mixed with enthusiasm. We heard Andrew talking about the flâneur walking around the city. So Baudelaire is creating something completely new. A poetry about the self, but what grows there? What grows out of this self? A flower of evil. And again, you know, you think of bourgeois aesthetics, flowers are beautiful. The beautiful and the good are the same thing, but now we've got a beautiful evil flower. So we've got something, again, something different going on. And of course, this will be easier to show you. We've got Manet, and we heard this morning about Manet, and I'll just try and say something very basic about what I think is interesting about Manet, because he's doing what Flaubert did. This is social realism. This was a picture of, it's a very classical pose. There are many pictures of people, of, you know, women, naked women on beds, right? It's a classical pose. But as soon as people saw it, they were shocked. And in fact, at the exhibition, they took it down. And it wasn't shown for many years. Why? I mean, if you go to the exhibition, it's full of naked women, full of them. Why is this offensive? The reason is that everybody, as soon as they saw it, knew it wasn't a goddess. It wasn't Venus. It was a prostitute. And it was, from a series of clear signs, it's a prostitute. And not only is it a prostitute, but she's looking straight at you, as if to say, not come into my beautiful house, but how much money? And everybody immediately said, this is a prostitute from the slums of Paris, the bad parts of Paris. So in some ways, as we'll see in a minute, some ways Manet is a social critique of the new relations of power in Paris where women could be bought and sold. But in other ways, it's art for art's sake. Because if we look at some of the models, this is Titian, nobody walks out of this one. Or Giorgione's, or Goya's a bit later. These are all very famous pieces of work that don't offend anybody. But what Manet is doing is using the memory of older artistic models to somehow play games with the audience. And so what he's doing is, although there's a social comment, there's also some sort of reference to other artworks. And actually, that reference to other artworks, it begins to be an allegory, and I won't go into too much, but it becomes about formal innovation, not about content. As he said this morning, you've got the woman looking down, looking disengaged, not interested, but her reflection is she's leaning forward and talking to the man. So in reality, in the mirror, she's making a financial, she's a prostitute, basically. She's making a financial relationship with a man. But when we see her here, she's a blank face. So again, very much a social comment at the time. And of course, you look at this, Andrew said this morning that Manet left the brush strokes on his paintings. He made it very rough. But not here. Here really shows all his technique. I mean, here's the oranges here. If you see this in a good reproduction, they're fantastic. You could just eat them. And I always like the foil on the champagne bottles. Really meticulous on this. And it's straight out of Marx. Remember yesterday we talked about the commodity becoming its own thing. These are beautiful objects. No, you don't think who made these things. These are beautiful objects for purchase. And she's one of them. She's just an object. And if you wanted to, you can really see Marx's first chapter of Capital here. You could do that. Of course, Walter Benjamin once said, I'd like to rewrite Capital just through quotations, but that's another story. But so what Manet is doing, a lot of very interesting social critique, but at the same time he's using a lot of formal innovations, you know, the distorted mirror there, the way in which the perspective is not right. So modernism becomes some other things. And of course this leads us on to the first encounter between Marxism and modernism. And I'll use the writings, slightly later writings, of George Lukács. He was absolutely the most influential Marxist theorist of the 20s and 30s. And he says there's a real difference between realism and modernism. That realism is progressive and modernism is decadent. And the reason is that he says realism, the realists are open to history. And he uses the example of Balzac. Now, Balzac, the French writer, is a royalist. He's right-wing. He believes the monarchy should be back. He hates the revolution. He hates the middle classes. He thinks industrial growth is terrible, etc. But Lukács says, and Marx actually, says he's the finest critic of capitalist society. Why? Because he shows that society in all its complexity, and it's open to history. And what Lukács says is in 1848 we get a separation between realism begins to break up, and on the one hand we get naturalism, and these are maybe difficult terms, but naturalism means we just copy reality, almost like a photograph. So a photograph just takes a picture of reality. Whereas realism actually doesn't just take a picture of reality, it attempts to show how that reality is constructed. On the other side of naturalism, we get subjectivism. Lukács calls it symbolism. Subjectivism, where the world is just you. So this might be naturalism, because this is Caillebotte. We saw one of his pictures this morning. It's the new Paris, but it's a new, quite horrible Paris. It's a Paris of rational straight lines. It's a machine Paris. And everybody there is an isolated individual. There's no communication. These aren't the people. Do you remember Courbet's people, or even Repin's people? This is not the people. This is the big city crowd. The alienated big city crowd. And in this naturalism, I'm using this word again here, what Lukács calls reification. Actually, we can no longer see society as a whole. We can only see either the surface or our own subjective images of it.